Hey there, I'm Tal Zlotnitsky from Ignite IT Consulting. You know me from the Braving Business podcast, but when I'm not behind the mic, I'm helping tech startups and established companies ignite their full potential. I also help entrepreneurs and businesses in distress reset for success. With over three decades of entrepreneurial success, I bring hands-on experience to drive growth, navigate turnarounds, raise capital, and lead through innovation. Whether it's executive coaching or strategic transformation, I'm here to turn your business challenges into success stories. Visit igniteitconsulting.com and let's spark that change together. That's igniteitconsulting.com. Your journey to business brilliance starts now.
And one last quick thing. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay on after the show to learn more about the Braving Business podcast and other great episodes for you to discover. And now, let's get the show started. Well, hello there.
Sir, oh, sir, how goes it?
It goes well. That was emphatic and I loved it. Thank you very much.
Well, you're unusually emphatic. I figured I would return.
That's true.
Is there
that's
a verb for empathy? I mean, I guess it's just emphatic and there's no other word for that.
I'm the most emphaticness, emphatically, whatever. So, yeah. How was your weekend, bud?
My weekend was fine. It wasn't, anything to write home about. It was kind of just low key. Yeah, you know what? I watched my granddaughter. It was supposed to be for a few hours. My daughter decided she wanted to take out some bushes in her backyard and front yard. And it was, I assumed it to be a 2 or 3 hour thing. And 9 hours later, I was still watching a one-year-old baby who was interested in being fed and not through any bodily capability that I possess. So that was a little difficult, but it was fun. It was really nice to spend time with her. She's lovely.
First of all, I'm sure you enjoyed every single minute. And you just reminded me of something. Did you know that all mammals, all human babies are born with breast milk inside them? Did you know that?
No way. Yeah. Is that right?
When my son was born, I took him to his 3 week old checkup or whatever. And the nurse was there and, you know, oh, he looks great, whatever. And then she says, you know, because, you know, all the babies still have breast milk. I'm like, what are you talking about? And she reached over and pinched his nipple and out came a little milk. And I was like, oh my God.
That is crazy. I did not know that. Joe, did you know that?
I did not know that.
Well, we have already met our goal for the day, which is to bring something to our audience they did not know.
Hey, look, listen, if you ever need useless information, I am your man. I'm here for you.
Well, that's fantastic. How was your weekend?
It was good. It was good. We had Kara had some friends over that she hadn't seen. One of them lives on a boat sailing around the world. So when she's in town, we can only, you know, try to make the most of that time while she's here. And they came over and I cooked my ass off, and literally, like, I have none. You wouldn't be able to see it, but I made prime rib. I made fire roasted shrimp. I made my famous mashed potatoes. It was good. It was a smorgasbord of delight. So,
isn't a smorgasbord with a D at the end? I think you said it with a G.
I did say it with a G. That's because I live near Wisconsin, and they say smorgasbord, and I just throw in the G because I like to.
Gotcha. Very interesting. Joe, you would not know that about PJ, but he is a competitive barbecuer.
Yeah, I have a good friend down in Kansas, and I didn't understand the nuances of barbecue in America. I spent a little bit of time down there, but there's certain parts of the country that are pretty mad about their barbecue.
Yeah. Well, PJ is, he's more known for being a great cheerleader to his colleagues on the team, I believe. I think that's true, right? You'll say that about you?
Oh, my God, yes.
Is that fair?
Yes, yeah. Yes. I provide
there are other better barbecuers
relief
than you, but
oh yeah, they are.
But you did a great job this weekend, it sounds like.
I did. You know what? Next time you're out, I will replicate that.
I will take you up on that. Well, in the meanwhile, why don't we go ahead and tell our audience about our guest. We have a super interesting guest today, a very, very, very cool episode.
Very true. Not only is he dressed better than us, but
much better.
But
no one told you. I don't even own any ties anymore.
I'm going to leave my comment out. So anyway, today, Tal, our friend is Joe Roberts. Joe Roberts, also known as the Skid Row CEO. Joe is a successful Canadian entrepreneur, motivational speaker, author, and the co-founder of the Push for Change Foundation. He has received recognition in his work for advocating for homeless youth, including being the winner of the Courage to Come Back Award and the Meritorious Service Medal from the Governor General of Canada. So far, sounds like a great but kind of ordinary success story. Except Joe's story is anything but ordinary. You see, 25 years ago, Joe Roberts was pushing a shopping cart in Vancouver's notorious downtown east side as a homeless addict. You heard that right. He was homeless, pushing a shopping cart while being an addict. Joe overcame his drug addiction and chronic homelessness to become a roaring success. His story is a testament to the power of resilience and the human spirit, and we're so honored to be bringing you Joe's story today. Joe Roberts, Mr. Skid Row CEO, I have to say that I truly can't wait to share your incredible story with our audience, so thank you for joining us today on the Braving Business Podcast.
Thanks, PJ and Tal. It's just an opportunity to be here, and thank you for that warm welcome and introduction. By the way, you got meritorious right, and half the people in Canada don't pronounce that one right. So kudos to you the enunciation of meritorious.
Thank you. The tally for me saying things right versus incorrect heavily weighed on the incorrect side. So thank you. I will take that tally point anytime I can.
I was just going to say, don't ask him to say nuclear because he wouldn't say it right. Never. Joe, not only is he dressed better than us, he's also much better looking than us, PJ. That's I feel very intimidated today.
Hey, speak for yourself. I am gorgeous in the dark.
You are. That is true. Joe, thank you. Thank you for being with us today. Look, your story is mind-blowing. When I started preparing for this episode and looked at your history, and there's a great video that I would highly recommend our audience watches, and we'll put in the show notes. That is simply mind-blowing. There's no other way to describe it. This kind of transformation is not the kind of thing that you often hear about. It's the stuff of movies. I'd love to have you maybe tie where you wound up prior to your turnaround, to the challenges you faced as a young man. I know you lost your father. You dealt with abuse. Could you tell us the story of how you wound up where you were, pushing shopping carts in the streets of Vancouver, which, by the way, for those of you who don't know, it's extremely cold in Vancouver. I mean, almost all the time. So if there's one place you don't want to be homeless, it's you don't want to be homeless anywhere, but right. Certainly Vancouver wouldn't be a place you want to be homeless. How did you wind up there, Joe?
Yeah, I think it's just a classic case of systemic breakdown and falling through the cracks. My first 8 years of life was idyllic. I lived in this sitcom-like family. You know, it was dad went to work, mom was a homemaker, older brother, younger sister, and a little dog with magical powers, you know. And I spent my days in the tree fort and playing in the back 40 on my little bike. And things were going along swimmingly well until life lifed us. In 1975, dad passed away. Now, he was a mean breadwinner, so we went from a lower middle class family to immediately under the poverty line. And mom, scrambling to do what she could to raise three kids, married quickly. Now, I don't fault her for that. It wasn't any way to besmirch my dad's memory. It was economic. You know, she had three kids to raise. The only problem is that the guy who came into our family next was a violent, abusive alcoholic. And you know, so at the age of 9, I went from a father who'd say things like, I love you, you can do and be anything. You know, a man who spoke to my potential, to a man who would say things like, you're stupid, you're dumb, and you'll never amount to anything. The thing that I know is that when you pick up stories like that when you're a kid, they can follow you your entire life. You know, there's probably people listening to this call that, you know, think about, you know, different things that happened to them when they were 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That still impact the way they see the world. For me, you know, that set me on a bit of a trajectory. At 9, I was trying to fit into the world. You know, I was awkward at school, so I was a target for bullying. Didn't fit in at home. I was, you know, a target to my stepfather's rage and abuse and violence. And when the opportunity with my brother and his older friends presented itself to use drugs, I joined. And the really important piece here, and I've shared this with over a million young people, I didn't try drugs because I thought it would be cool or fun or I was curious about the impact. I did it to fit in. I wanted community. I wanted connection, and I wanted to belong. And I used drugs, and for that sole purpose. It wasn't peer pressure; it was self pressure. But what happened is, I went home, and for the first time in my life, I wasn't afraid. You know, the uncertainty, the fear, the violence. My stepfather didn't have that impact on me anymore. So it was a, you know, it was a thing that I ran to. You know, when you think about the last couple of years, COVID and all the changes that are going on in the world, how human beings naturally gravitate towards something that alters our emotional state. Some it's social media, some it's scrolling, some of it's, you know, gaming or streaming media. Some people it's food, some people it's alcohol, some people it's drugs. When we're feeling not really good, we try to find a way to alter our emotional state. The thing that I picked would end up taking me to the darkest places you can go at in a Western world. Yeah.
You know, I just recently watched I couldn't even get through the whole movie, a movie on Netflix about the life of Marilyn Monroe, which I knew very little about. You know, my girlfriend and I put it on expecting some glamour, some glitz, right? It was a Saturday night. The first 45 minutes of that movie is about as bleak a 45 minutes of any movie I've ever seen. The fear that this little girl lived with, her mother was very mentally unstable. She was subject to a lot of abuse, which never, frankly, didn't stop well into her life. But what really caught my eye was a scene where she was driving with her mother through a fire. There was a forest fire that her mother was driving through, insanely driving through the forest fire, which of course you're not supposed to do. And the look of sheer terror on her face, it catches your breath. I mean, you realize, you know, there but for the grace of God, and you were not fortunate enough for through no fault of your own, someone came into your life that absolutely caused you to stop cold in your development and just focus on fear. And when fear is our most significant feeling, emotion, it's like a tree growing, you know, sideways. It is as devastating, particularly to a young person, as anything. How did that continue for you? So that fear manifests into drug use. That drug use numbs you, it sounds like. You're able to deal with that fear, or at least not be confronted with it as frontally as you were without it. Where did it take you?
Well, what happened next is the consequences of making those choices repetitively over time. You know, one of the problems with making mistakes as a kid is you don't pay for it right away. And because the adolescent mind is not really developed to understand consequences, it's like, wow, I did that and got away with it. Everybody said I should be scared of that, but I got away with it. So repeat, repeat, repeat. And then boom, by the time I was 15, I got kicked out of the house. At 16, I dropped out of school. At 17, I found myself wrapped up in the justice system. You know, I had one shining thing in my life at that time, and it was a girl I was dating in grade 10, and she meant the world to me. You know, I was head over heels in love. She was my very first high school crush, but she sat me down and said, I'm not going where you're going. And that relationship dissolved, and I had all of that abandonment. And how I coped with things was more of the, you know, more of the substance, more of the drinking, and more of the lifestyle associated with that. Wore my welcome out in the little town that I lived in north of Toronto and decided to go west. You know, the proverbial geographical cure. I took my, you know, my little Adidas pleather. I don't know if you remember the old pleather Adidas bags, red and blue. Mine was yellow, broken handle. Got on a Greyhound bus, and 3.5 days later, I landed in Vancouver. Now, here I was, a 17-and-a-half-year-old kid with a bunch of baggage and trauma that was unresolved. I'd lost my dad, not dealt with it. The abuse of my stepfather, didn't deal with it. And now I was in this big city. And over the next few years, the wheels just came off my life. And I remember when I got off the bus that morning, the sun was coming up, and I had this overwhelming feeling of aspiration. I thought, yes, Vancouver, this is where I'm going to get a mulligan. I'm going to get a do-over. It's going to really happen for me here. And that park that I had that celebratory moment, I was sleeping in 3 weeks later. And it just, over the next years, nothing got any better. And by the time it was the late 90s, I was a kid pushing a shopping cart, collecting cans and bottles to support an opioid dependency.
This is heartbreaking. And it's also, I'm very sorry that you went through this. It also really kind of tells how easily people can spiral out. And even in Canada, where you have, supposedly better social networks and social nets, I guess, to catch people falling through, it still happens. And it's terrible. And a lot of times, I think there's an idea, at least in the U.S., where, you can do anything you want to do. You can pull yourself up by the bootstraps, which, of course, many people do. But many people aren't able to. And it could be like you were going through a dependency problem. It could be a mental health problem. It could be purely situational. And it's just terrifying how, when you talk to people who've been through it, like yourself, and we'll get to how you kind of came out on top and changed your life around and everything, which I can't wait to get to. But it is, I just want to take a moment to really recognize how pervasive and how easy it is for people to be left behind and not get the empathy that they need and not get the sympathy that they need, because at least when, in the U.S., you kind of look at them like, well, you did this to yourself. There must be something wrong with you. I'm not going to, I'm going to give you a buck or 20 bucks or whatever it is. I'm going to buy you a Coke. But I don't want to give you any money because I think you're going to go and buy a bottle of booze, or you're going to go get your next hit. And the story is always way more complicated than that. And, first of all, thank you for sharing your story. How long were you in this space, this pushing the shopping cart, being addicted? How long were you there for?
Yeah. Chronically homeless was towards the end. Insecure housing was from about the time I was 15. But living in the streets of Vancouver was from about the time I was 17, 17 and a half to 24. So I, my late teens and early 20s, but the misnomer with youth homelessness is that you're homeless. It doesn't look like that in the beginning. I had housing sometimes, I had a couch to sleep on. So it's invisible, which makes it very insidious when you're trying to address it. Because by the time a kid is sitting on a piece of cardboard in front of a liquor store or a 7-Eleven, a lot has happened. And I think to echo what you said, PJ, is that there are millions of young people and people, not just young people, who don't have the luxury of being able to make a mistake without it costing them an enormous amount. How fortunate I was to have that mom and to have those first stable 8 years. All of us went through stuff when we were growing up. It's part of the rite of passage. The thing is that when we hit the gravel, if we've got good guardrails, we can bounce off that a little bit without going down into the rhubarb. Unfortunately, those guardrails don't exist. So not all families' childhoods are created equal. And
sure.
And that really drives a lot of the philanthropy and the work I do today.
So you were there 6.5, 7 years of dealing with this through different iterations of, home insecurity to outright homelessness. What was the turning point? What made you step away from the streets, or allowed you to step away from the streets and begin your journey towards recovery and success for yourself? And how did your adversities shape your outlook on moving forward in your life and in business eventually?
Yeah. So there was, you know, there's many, many moments when you look back, but the one I often share was that moment of existential crisis. It was 3 days before Christmas. I was sitting in a park bench in downtown Vancouver. It was pouring rain, cold, very cold rain. And I was going through opiate withdrawal. And the only way to describe that for, you know, listeners who don't understand that as a process, it's like the worst flu you've ever had times 100. So think of a time when you've been really sick. Now imagine you're really sick with those flu-like symptoms, except you're now on a park bench in the cold and the rain. And you know, $10 makes it go away. And you begin to understand the vicious cycle, right? Like, think of the last time you had the flu. If $10 made it go away. I didn't want to be who I was. I was done being that guy, but I didn't have the tools to change that on my own. I needed help. I walked into a bar. I needed $10. I didn't want to rob or steal. I needed $10. And I walked into the bar and I walked out 10 minutes later, having sold the only item I had left in the world that was worth anything. It was the boots off my feet. And I remember, I'll never, ever forget the feeling of that, my torn up old sock touching that cold concrete sidewalk. And in that moment, I was completely filled with despair, hopelessness. You know, when I think about the last couple of years and the stuff people have gone through, when COVID first hit 4 years ago and people started to drop and their mental health, you know, and all of the things that we've experienced, I sat back and said, I know what this looks and feels like. I've been here before. You know, in that moment of despair, I was fighting, like, how am I going to get through another sunset? And in that moment, I cried out for help. And I believe that what happened in there was this miracle that I finally became willing to do something different, to take accountability for my actions and to do whatever it took to change. And I remember I said a little prayer. I said, God, give me a second chance. I don't deserve it, but give me a second chance. And if you give me a second chance, I promise I won't squander the opportunity. I'll make the most of it and I'll do something to help others. That set me on a course. With the help of my mom, she got me into, I called her the next day. She flew out, brought me back to Ontario. I entered into a drug and alcohol treatment program that led me to going back to school. 3.5 years later, I graduated with honors, 3.94 GPA. Not bad for a guy who most of his life thought he was stupid. And I went out in the business world and I absolutely crushed it. And I remember an interview like 10 years later in the business magazine was asking me, they said, you know, you're successful in spite of living on the streets. I said, that's where you're wrong. I'm successful because I lived on the streets, because I learned how to communicate with people, because I know what a bad day really looks like. And it's not a 300-point drop in the Dow, right? Because I have deep empathy and understanding, which made a great career in business development, because having that empathy and understanding problems and solving problems, you know, there were just so many assets. You know, one of the biggest ones when I got into the tech world is the ability to solve unsolvable problems. You see, I think differently. I don't go from A to B. People said, you got to go to A to B, to B to C, C to D. I said, no, you don't. You go from A to W. You know, I love breaking rules. I mean, not real rules get you into trouble, but thinking differently about creative problem solving. I lived in a world for over almost a decade where I woke up every single morning with an unsolvable problem and I solved it. And so today, the asset that I bring when I speak or I talk or I mentor or I coach is talking to people about adaptability and change. Like resilience in action is the ability to bounce off life on life's terms and keep moving in the face of negative emotion, because that's where possibility is found. That's where the solution is. And with all of the change that we're faced with, and it's not slowing down anytime soon, skill sets for good leaders are, how do you navigate change? the emotional impact of it, and the actions that are needed to move forward. And so in less than 12 years, I went from a guy pushing a shopping cart to being the Canadian version of the American dream.
Wow.
As you were talking, I was reflecting on a song that I heard maybe last year or a couple of years ago. And for some reason, I thought of it this week while I was taking a walk. I like to walk and meditate. And the song is It's Okay Not to Be Okay. I don't know if that song, you guys are familiar with that song. It's actually a pretty nice, catchy tune. What's interesting to me about that song is that it is not commonly perceived in our society that it is okay not to be okay. And what I just heard you say when you were talking about what resilience truly is, it's being able to accept that you're not always going to be okay. Obviously for you, that is probably your circumstance that taught you that, you know, you're not going to be okay and you need to persevere. Like you said, you had all these problems and every single day you had to solve impossible problems. Not being okay was a way of life. For most people and leaders, people in leadership, people aspiring to lead, entrepreneurs, there is this constant angst. There's this constant underlying feeling of, ah, it's not okay. And oftentimes you try to deny it. You try to pretend it's not there, even to yourself. And the end result is it impacts your well-being. And I'm hearing you talk about embracing, or on some level, embracing the realities of life, which is that things get in the way of nirvana all the time. And being able to succeed is oftentimes about just being able to stare that in the face and carry on anyway. How did you get there? I mean, it sounds like, I mean, I'm seeing you nod your head, so you're in agreement. Mm-hmm. How do you get there from where you were? I mean,
part of the blessing of being that broken is it eviscerates the illusion of self-sufficiency. Leadership in our culture is siloed. So when people in a leadership position, one, there's this stigma attached with raising our hand and saying, I need some help. You know, the name of your brand, Braving Business, I think one of the bravest things we can do is say, hey, I need some help with this. I ain't got, you know, like most of the time I got this. Some days you don't got this. And if you don't know how to raise your hand for help, where I come from, you die. Because sometimes you have to rat yourself out in order to move forward, and you got to bring people together. Part of the misnomer with my story is that I'm pulled my socks up and got on with it. Oh, good for you. Gosh darn. That couldn't be further from the truth. I'm here today because of over 10,000 people who helped me carry that load until I could stand on my own. You know, having the ability to say, I'm not okay, I need some help, I think is that track we're on right now when we talk about empathy and leadership. I think that the bravest we can be, but we're in this time of change, right? We also celebrate performance. And anything that gets in the way of performance, we tend to oppress and not talk about. And then there's also the gender stuff. It's like, as a guy, big boys don't cry. All that, you know, tough machismo stuff that's not particularly useful when we talk about mental health. I think the greatest leaders that I've ever met are people who are vulnerable, they're transparent, and they surround themselves with people who are stronger at them and the things that they're weak at.
True. True. First of all, Tal and I were communicating back and forth, and your story is incredibly impactful. And so, first of all, I mean, just thank you for sharing your time with us on this episode. And we're going to keep going. It's not like I'm closing it out, but I'm just saying thank you. It's been so impactful for me. I'm sitting here tearing up, listening to your story. It also makes me think about how experience is singular, right? We can all be in the same environment. We can all be seeing the same event, but that experience that I have versus someone else who's standing next to me might be different. And I say that because you mentioned that you're going through what you went through is a blessing. And it showed you emphatically, again, here's that word, right in front of you, that this is your backstop. This is as low as you, as Joe Roberts, are going to go. And now everything is ahead of you, and you know how bad things can get. So you have that sense of reference. Other people have different sets of references, not so much about what's bad, but also what's good, right? Like, I lived with very, very successful people, and I know it's possible, right? So we all pull these experiential things that help shape us every day, that help us grow as human beings, help grow as entrepreneurs and business leaders and whatnot. You've been teaching all over the world. You've been helping so many people. What specific insights do you think you've gained from overcoming these many failures? Not many, but what you've gone through. Overcoming what you've gone through. What insights do you emphasize to people who come to you that you think is great nuggets for them to go on their own path with? And so, like, which ones would you like to highlight for our audience, but also why are they important?
Yeah, there's a lot of ways I could answer that, but there's one that means the most to me. And that is that the tragedy of life isn't that it ends too soon. It's that we wait too long to begin it because of fear. The greatest tragedy I see is that every single person in front of me has the light in them. The key is in their pocket. The possibility is there, but we hold back because of fear or past stories or glass ceilings or that internal dialogue that we have. You know, my experience shows me that, you know, I went from a guy pushing a shopping cart living under a viaduct to live in the dream and more, which we'll get to. But when I talk to people, I hear what's blocking them. And what I try to gently do and coach them is to say, no, you're more than that. You're more than your experiences. You're more than the things that happened to you. You're more than the things that people said to you. You're more than the trauma. You're more than this identity. You are energy. You can go out in this world and do absolutely extraordinary things. And so the thing that I reside in is this idea of possibility, of human possibility. We aren't what we think we are. There's so much more on the other behind that. And I see that beauty peeking out from people. But sometimes, you know, you meet folks and it's like they live in a house with dirty windows. Their light doesn't get out and the light out here doesn't get in. And that's the thing that breaks my heart. And I know that experientially because I clean my windows.
Well, it's a great analogy. I mean, I love clean my windows. Yep. or wipe your glasses, which I've said to people, my son especially. David Brooks wrote the columnist David Brooks wrote an article in this month's Atlantic Monthly. It's called Chicken Littles Are Ruining America. And I know you're Canadian and we're not going to get into politics, but his point is there's so much negativity and people are marinating in it.
Mm-hmm.
And you are your environment. So if you're going to choose to marinate in conspiracy theories or fear or hate or anger, don't be surprised if the emotion you experience the most and most, you know, with the greatest intensity is one of those feelings, anger, fear. It is ultimately an inside job. I mean, being better, achieving your potential is an inside job. I can't guarantee you success. I don't think, Joe, you're telling anyone that you're guaranteeing them a particular outcome. But your quality of life is going to be
dramatically impacted by how you think and where you set your own limits. And I think that, you know, as I hear you speak, that really comes through. I mean, I think you're ultimately a huge optimist. And I, you know, how that is how you became one. It's a bit astounding to me, given what you've been through. But is that true? I mean, would you say that you're actually that you're an optimist about humanity and its possibilities?
Yeah. 100%. Look, everything that you experience in the modern world, the phone that you use, the car that you drive, the planes that we fly on once only existed in the ether of possibility. Electric light didn't exist in your house 150 years ago. Every single thing that we've experienced in the last 150 years, in the last 60 years of this rapid advancement in technology, once only existed in someone's imagination. Ergo, the solutions to the big things that we have out there exist in the ether of imagination. When you focus your radio channel tuned into negativity, hate, divisiveness, and all this other nonsense, what it does is it prevents you from accessing possibility. So I make a choice every day to see the world through possibility. Does the stuff out there impact me? Absolutely, it does, but I have a choice. And, you know, Charlie Tremendous Jones, I remember he made me cry, and he says, you know, Joe, he says, you know what the greatest tragedy of life is? And I said, what, Charlie? He says, billions of people aren't going to get to know how beautiful a human being you are. And he said, as long as you're in the hope business, you'll never be out of business. And so that's the business I want to be in. And it's not just Pollyanna, you know, rainbows and butterflies. It's choosing to look at the world through a different perspective, one that points towards solutions. You know, on all of the stuff that's going on in the world, I have one question to people who are wrapped up in that stuff. Is doing that, engaging in that, making you a happier human being? Is it moving you towards your goals and your hopes and your dreams? And if it isn't, my goodness, life's too short.
Man, I don't know. I should have built a bomb shelter for myself. There's a lot of knowledge bombs dropping today.
Nice.
Jeez. So, first of all, thank you again for sharing all that, Joe. That's amazing. And I love that. I love that billions of people are not going to be able to, it's too bad for them because they're not going to be able to know you. That's so you're actually, you have projects. You're looking to change that, right? You have some goals in what you're looking at doing to inspire people globally and future leaders globally. Can you tell us what it's like to inspire leaders or what you would like to inspire leaders to do more of, or inversely, to do less of? And what is the message that you're most passionate about when delivering, or what's the message you're most passionate about to deliver to these leaders?
I think that in the context of, let's say, change or resilience, it's about shifting from a world that's full of probability, or, you know, we're going this way, it's likely going to get worse, is to look at the lens through, like, when you look at innovation cannot exist without a possibility mindset. And so it's getting folks to understand, how do you get the most out of yourself? How do you get the most out of the world? How do you get the most out of your team? It's looking and leaning into possibility versus probability. Probability is looking at the world and predicting what it's likely going to be tomorrow because of certain factors. And we're very good as human beings at predicting things. The problem is prediction is devoid of innovation and change. It's just going to be more of that on a different day. Possibility is saying, okay, here's where I'm at now. Well, who could I be tomorrow? Here's where my team is today. Who could we be tomorrow? Here's where our company is now. What could that look like a year from now? And sort of marinating in those opportunities. The story, that human story of transformation, it's not my story. It's a collective story. This is why we love Rocky One and Blindside, because they speak to the adversity and challenge in each and every one of us. So when leaders embrace this, then they can help people tap in to purpose and passion. And when they tap into purpose and passion, boom, look out, because there's this nuclear reaction. Did I say it right or wrong? Did I say it Canadian nuclear?
A little off.
Yeah, I know.
I'm totally fine with it.
But there's this this reaction where people start performing at a different level because now they're inspired. Simon Sinek is doing a really good job on talking to this subject matter over the last few years. And I just love listening to it. He first came out with the why, not the how and the what. And now he's on to the inspired leadership stuff. And I really think that's where we need to, you know, that's where we need to go. And so I like to leverage the story to drive those kinds of, you know, thematic talks and content workshops and material.
So one thing some of our listeners may say to that, and I'm thinking about that as someone that has been a CEO multiple times, has been in leadership. I've run organizations with very large teams and organizations with very few people. That what ends up happening is you end up spending most of your time as a leader dealing with tactical things. You're not able to step back and identify those opportunities because you're so busy, you know, surviving, many leaders would say. So given that's reality, I mean, we're not going to, you know, I think everyone would like to spend more time, or I would say many people would like to spend more time thinking about the big picture and impacting people's lives in a positive way. I'm an optimist and I believe that most people are good. And yet I think reality is most people also feel, particularly leaders, that they have to focus on the next target, the next milestone, the bottom line, et cetera. How do you reconcile those two things, Joe?
I think that one is sort of, you know, it's your day-to-day KPIs and metrics, but it has to be on the foundation of possibility versus probability. I get that. You know, there's the work to do, the things that need to get done. We've got to move down the ball down the field. We've got our quarterly, you know, reports. We've got analysts in Wall Street to deal with. But I think that a great leader, like a great coach, instead of talking about CEOs, because then you can get down a wormhole, a great coach sees the player's possibility. The player can't see that, but the coach can. And the coach can see the team's potential. The team may not be able to see it, but the coach does. And the coach holds that possibility for player and team and moves them towards the championship. So it's not looking at what is presenting now. It's what's behind that. And it's a lot more difficult. It's easy to say. It's a lot more difficult to practice that possibility. And then there's pieces that you work through, the action, the inspiration, and knowing roadblocks are part of the game. What you just described is a situational and psychological roadblock that can kick us out of the creating that ongoing context of possibility. Because what happens is reason pops in and goes, yeah, but it's never going to change.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's reason. I think it's cynicism, and I unfortunately, we are wired for it, and there are people around us who drip that into our veins, whether it's the news or, in some cases, parents, friends, colleagues. So yeah, cynicism I think is a poison. It makes you believe that why bother, and I think your point is, well, if you don't bother, you're guaranteeing a certain outcome. And it's not the outcome you want. Like you said, what is it that you want? Do you want to be happy? Is this bringing you any closer to happiness? And yet, I'm not pushing against that because I don't agree with it. I agree with it wholeheartedly. I still think we are not as clear as I'd like to be with our audience about what is the process to follow to be able to bridge the tactical reality of your everyday life as a leader in most organizations with this objective? What's the process? What would you say are practical things someone can do that is not essentially opting to not do the tactical work that frankly has to be done? It's not instead of something, it's in addition to. How do you do that? Do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, I think you have to hold the possibility loosely while you continue to move forward in action, connecting to purpose and navigating the roadblock. So Dr. Richardson and I actually create a piece of IP around how you take a possibility and operationalize it. So I took a possibility of doing an Ironman. I said, I want to do that. Why? Because it's hard and I like doing hard things because that's just kind of my thing. So there's I'm holding the possibility that a 53-year-old non-athlete is going to do an Ironman. So holding that as the possibility, it's highly unlikely. So I totally hear the skepticism, but I'm holding that loosely and I continue to get into action, connect to a bigger reason why I want to do that, and then navigate the roadblocks. But the possibility, it takes energy and effort to hold that possibility in the face of negativity and all of those other things, because those are very, very real things to manage. So in the context of how do you use that elsewhere, you could use that for your own wellness, for your own fitness. You could use that on a business objective. Okay, I did 1 million last year. I want to do 5 million this year. Okay, that's a possibility. How do you do that? It seems very unlikely. We've never done five. We've only ever done 1 million. Okay, let's hold that possibility. If it was going to happen, what would it look like? Do you remember the 13 kids that were stuck in a cave in Thailand? You remember that? When they were all stuck together, they were going to die. There was a U.S. Marine. You watch this. It's on the documentary. U.S. Marine. He's got everybody together. He's got the amateur cavers, which they were the only hope in trying to get these kids out. One of them happened to be an anesthesiologist from America. And he says, well, what if we anesthetize the kids? And they just kept running into problem, problem, problem. No, they're going to die. They're going to die. They're going to die. We're going to go to jail. No, 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 no. Probability, probability, probability. Then the Marine asked this question. If it was possible, what would it look like? Forget it. Well, I get that. It's not possible. But if it was possible, what would it look like?
So effectively, you have to, it sounds like what you're saying is ask a question to which you simply refuse to reflect on the why nots. I mean, there's a question that is about the how. How do you do something that seems impossible? It makes me think of the movie Apollo 13. I don't know if you guys saw it, where basically they assembled the pieces that were on the ship. And they're like, that's it. That's all we got. We need to save them with this, you know? And proof positive, it is possible, right? Impossible is only impossible until you do it. And it sounds like you're calling on leaders and people in general to just refuse to succumb to cynicism and disbelief and push through with two things in mind: accomplishment and doing it in a way that reflects well on you as a human being, and not from the standpoint of how you look, but how you feel.
Yeah. I think that if I was to answer it simple, and you asked this question a few minutes ago, and I should have just answered it this way, is to withhold judgment of the idea or possibility. Because oftentimes that's where we kill it. We kill it with good reasons. And there are great reasons why at 53 you shouldn't do an Ironman. There's really great reasons why you shouldn't attempt to try and fly. There's really great reasons why so many of the things that we experience today, we shouldn't bother, because there's good reasons to suggest that you won't be successful. And yet every entrepreneurial story, you know, has that entrepreneur who refuses to give it up. They refuse to pass judgment on their possibility. It's also the thing that we admire most in social warriors. I have a dream. Do you now? Okay, what's the likelihood of that? And we admire someone who plants the flag. In fact, planting a flag of possibility attracts people. You know, because they're like, I hold that possibility too. Let's work on it together.
So you kind of reminded me of my dating life, where you say, so you're saying there's a chance. That's awesome. So I hear you. When I was 53, there was no way that I was thinking about any kind of Ironman competition. Sitting at 55, still in the same boat. Not going to do it. But to raise awareness for youth homelessness, clearly you're a man of action, because you walked across Canada. And now, is that the entire country, or like a province? Like, did you go from, like, you know, street A to street B? Like, what you did the whole thing? Tell us about that. What was that like? What did you do to embark on that challenge? What impact did you hope to achieve, and what did you learn?
Yeah, thanks for that, PJ. And I think that this is where a lot of my conviction comes in. So I came back from an event where I spoke and we had this huge impact. And on the airplane, sitting beside Sean, sitting at the front of the plane, I said, I'd love to take this idea and inspire the entire country on how we could better protect kids. You know, so it was the essence of what happened at that corporate event. What can we do as a national engagement project? And Sean turns to me, he says, well, when Canadians want to raise money, they run across the country. Why don't you run across Canada? Now, you have to understand, Sean's a former Olympic athlete, right? So naturally, he thinks sport. I looked at him, I said, why don't you run across the country? You know, I'm kind of busy this week. So that was ha, ha, ha. And I said, well, if I run, how would it be different? He says, why don't you push a shopping cart? It's a symbol of chronic homelessness in North America. It's a thing you're trying to avoid for every kid, and it's a throw to your story. And as far as I know, nobody's ever pushed a shopping cart across Canada. So the rational mind would say, that's ridiculous. At the time this idea hit the ether, I was 46 years old, non-athlete, failed grade 9 and 10 gym. The idea of walking, by the way, the distance that they ended up walking was 5,600 and 25 miles. So that's the distance from Manhattan to the Santa Monica Pier, back to Manhattan with one Canadian winter thrown in there for character building. You know, in the middle of winter, I was 1,000 miles north of Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Right? Jeez.
So we start with this just BHAG of an idea. We have no idea how we're going to fund it. We have no idea how we're going to get partners. We have no idea how we're going to engage. And I have no idea how I'm going to mentally and physically actually do that. But we held that idea long enough until some of those things started to fall in place. And when they did, they gave us confidence to continue to move forward. A lot of times in nurturing a possibility, you need to take steps forward. Dr. Carol Dweck talks about this in Growth versus Fixed Mindset. If you got a fixed mindset, you're going to discard it right away. I don't have the talent. There's no way. And it gives you a reason to stop. But a growth mindset or a possibility mindset says, it's possible. I don't know how, but I'll take some steps forward and I'll figure it out. And when you take action in the face of negative emotion and something good happens, builds momentum. Yeah. And so, you know, it took 3 years. We raised $1 million. We got our shopping cart, our team together, and over the next 17 months, waking up every morning at 5 a.m., I walked from St. John's, Newfoundland to downtown Vancouver, a distance of 5,625 miles or 9,064 kilometers. And I successfully walked across the second widest country on earth. We raised a couple million bucks. We engaged over 100,000 kids. We impacted government at municipal, provincial, and federal levels. And I did something that was so astronomically difficult. So when I stand in front of a group of people today and say anything is possible, you know, I believe that because I didn't read it in a book or see it in a movie. I used to be a guy pushing a shopping cart in the downtown East Side addicted to heroin. And everything in my life is a testament to human possibility. And I'm not particularly special.
Well, I don't know about that last part, but I think your point is we are all special. On every one of us is capable of special. And I think really that's the point. You clearly are special. It's hard to not look at your life story. And I do want to end on a Hollywoodian note because I believe that, you know, PJ's wife is a best-selling author, as guests as listeners know well, and has had a book turned into a movie. And I think that your story is worthy of, I know you've written a book. I think your story is worthy of becoming a movie. And we were talking before the podcast, you mentioned that it also had a love story to it. Do you mind ending our interview with that? I think it would be a great way to punctuate today.
So we're building the campaign and I get this email out of nowhere and I look at the address. And I hadn't talked to this person in 28 years. Ooh. It was the girl that I dated in grade 10. And we struck up a conversation. We met over coffee, purely platonic in the beginning. We fell in love. And we ended up getting married 2 months before the push for change. That was Marie, and she was our campaign director. And the entire campaign wouldn't have happened without her. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm 6 miles above the earth on any given moment. She's she's brass tacks. She's an accountant by trade. She knows systems, processes. So as we came up with ideas, she said, how are we going to operationalize that? She's very, very smart. She managed the entire campaign. And if it wasn't for her, she was the heart behind the cart. And so, you know, when I look back on my life, I'm 57 now, and I look back on my life, it all began with a leadership conversation. We don't understand the impact we can have on people. We really don't. You know, each one of us can count 5 people that have had an impact on us. And back in the day on a park bench, there was a guy named Gus. And he looked at me, and I was dirty and disheveled, black fingernails, scruffy hair, broken yellow teeth, clothes I've been wearing for a year. And he said, Joe, he said, there's more to you than you can see. You can't see it. I can. If you were to get your life together, you can go out into the world and do amazing things with your life. And I just feel really blessed that I got that second chance. And I want to spend the rest of my days sharing that idea with people and create an epidemic of possibility, because if we're going to turn the corner as a species, I think that we need possibility thinkers and leaders.
Tal, you know, yeah, go ahead, PJ.
I was going to say, we've done dozens of episodes during this trek, you and I together, with wonderful people like Joe. This is the first episode that I've ever wanted to applaud afterwards. Like, Joe, first of all, I was going to ask you about the girl in 10th grade, just to find out, but that's amazing. I am so incredibly tickled by this. And, I just can't thank you enough for sharing all your story. And I'm sorry, Ty, I'm sure you had something more salient. I'm just gushing. You go ahead.
No. I mean, what I wanted to say was, there are people that you come across in your life, and it sounds like that such a person crossed your path while you were sitting on a park bench, whose ability to impact you in ways that simply can't be understood and to transcend what we as humans can comprehend, leads to a conclusion. Mine is that we are not alone in this universe, that we are all loved, and that you just need to be paying attention, because God, in my view, it's God, you can think of it as the universe, puts things in your path to set you on the right path. No matter where you are in your life right this minute, if you are willing to go down a path of greater satisfaction, being a more valuable member of society, being a better version of yourself, that path is available to you. It's available to you. You just need to choose it, like Joe chose it. Our guest today was Joe Roberts, the Skid Row CEO. This story is just remarkable. I feel so honored that you chose to share your time with us today. I know how in demand you are. Continued success. Keep on preaching, brother. PJ and I will do our part from this perch, because I couldn't agree with you more. And we talk about it often. In fact, it's part of my spiel when I talk to guests before the episode begins. Braving business is not about how phenomenal and brilliant and talented and, you know, just touched by God individuals are. It's about the fact that we all have it in us. We can all persevere. We can all learn. We can all grow. We can all achieve more than what we're achieving if we're determined. And the biggest takeaway from you know, 40 some odd episodes we've done so far, is that that's what separates the hugely successful and the most satisfied from the others. A refusal to take no for an answer, not quitting. And it doesn't mean you don't change course, but it does mean that if you're determined, like Joe is, you find a way. And I think if there's a sentence to end with today, it's that way is there to be found. You just need to be willing to find it. Joe Roberts, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tal. Thanks, DJ.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much. And that's a wrap, folks. Like what you heard and want to support the show? Please follow our page on LinkedIn and Facebook. Visit us on YouTube. And please like and rate us on all of your favorite podcast streaming services. You can also see exclusive content, subscribe for free to our weekly blog, support our sponsors, and soon buy our merchandise at www.bravingbusiness.com. Thanks for being a part of our production, and we'll see you next time on the Braving Business Podcast.